Nina Rees and her family immigrated to the United States from Iran in large part because of the American education system. Now the president and CEO of the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools, Nina reflects on education in the United States.
Having an opportunity to get an education here and the opportunities you get after you get a degree here are immense. And, you know, one of the hallmarks of what makes this country such a great country.
We discussed charter schools and the power of choice for parents in determining their children's educational path, as well as Nina's personal journey and the role education played in it. I'm Andrew Kaufman, and this is The Strategist, presented by the George W. Bush Presidential Center. Our guest this week is Nina Rees, the president and CEO of the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. She's also a longstanding policymaker, having spent time in both the U.S. Department of Education as well as in the White House working on domestic policy. Really a spectacular career. Nina, it's really a pleasure to have you on this morning. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And our co-host is our resident education expert, Ann Wicks, the Ann Kimball Johnson Director of the Education Reform Initiative at the Bush Institute. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Andrew.
So, Nina, I think we want to spend a lot of time talking about education, but one of our other topics that is at the forefront of our mind at the Bush Institute is immigration. And your personal story begins in Iran. And so I'd love to hear, about your childhood, what life was like in Iran, what led to your family moving here to the U.S.?
Yes, no. And the recent events in Afghanistan have reminded me a little bit about similar circumstances under which my parents left Iran, although they were not quite the same. So, as you mentioned, I was born and raised in Iran. My family left Iran in 1983. And part of the reason we left was because they wanted to give me and my brother access to a better education. I had attended private schools in Iran before the revolution. After the revolution, I started attending public schools, and the public schools under the Islamic Republic of Iran have a heavy dose of religion, interestingly enough. My father in particular was a Fulbright fellow who was educated here in the U.S., had got his postdoctorate here in the United States, and one of his friends found him a job at Virginia Tech. So we moved from Tehran, of all places, to Blacksburg, Virginia. So I was introduced to, the U.S. school system in Southwest Virginia, a small rural community with just one high school, considered one of the best high schools in Virginia at the time, and I believe it still is. But I was one of maybe a couple of students for whom English was not their first language. And one of the reasons why I was so attracted to President Bush's agenda and the idea of disaggregating data to showcase the gaps in achievement was because of my experience going to this very rural high school and how conveniently they kind of shoved some of the things they needed to address under the rug consistently. Now, I came from a family of individuals who cared about education. So for me, ultimately, I ended up in college and, I figured out my way out. But for other students who may not have had the means at the time, at least, this is in the 80s when people were not talking as much about the gaps in achievement. That was kind of a symbol to me of some of the issues in our public school system where you have schools that are seemingly doing great in the aggregate, but when you disaggregate the data, you're not going to necessarily see students do well. And so in my case, they were very quick to put me in classes that were easier. And they also kind of rushed me to graduate from high school very quickly. I was not a very popular student because I was from Iran. I would say a lot of the students simply remembered Iran based on the hostage crisis. So that experience was also kind of a rough experience, but also, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So for me, it was kind of good to go through that and to come out of it alive. And then eventually I went to college and moved to DC to work in public policy. And I'm grateful for every opportunity that I've been given in this country ever since.
You know, it's interesting. We've talked to several immigrants and new Americans, and a theme that constantly comes up is education for the immigrant family. That is one of the lead drivers in wanting to come to the United States. And also, once they're here, one of the focuses of the family is ensuring the education of the child. Did you, as a child, were you keenly aware of the sacrifices your parents were making to make sure that you got that education?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, they, you know, the idea of leaving Iran to get educated in the United States was always front and center for my father and everyone I knew. I mean, again, I was attending a private school when I was in Iran. So everyone I knew not only placed a premium on getting a good education, but also what America's higher education system has to offer was really front and center for sort of the families I was connected to back in Iran. And I believe it's still the same. I have cousins and family members in Iran, and they would give anything to move here and get a fraction of what Americans have access to. So this is one of those commodities in this country that is often, in my opinion, taken somewhat for granted, but one of those things that a lot of other countries, even some of the better, you know, like Germany, France, I mean, their higher education system is smaller. Getting to them is more difficult. So having an opportunity to get an education here and the opportunities you get after you get a degree here are immense. And, you know, one of the hallmarks of what makes this country such a great country.
Nina, someone had asked me the other day about what people, refugee families coming from Afghanistan, need in school systems. And I was like, I am the wrong person to ask this. I grew up here in the U.S., you know, so and it made me think about it. I'm like, you have to talk to folks who have done this, in particular who have immigrated under very intense circumstances, right? Like that the families coming to us right now from Afghanistan have been through a pretty traumatic upheaval, let alone just moving from Afghanistan to someplace like Virginia, as you described. That must have felt a little bit like moving to Mars, honestly, if you're a young teen thinking, where on earth have I landed? And I'm curious what advice you would give for educators who might be welcoming families from Afghanistan or any other refugee families coming in to their schools right now. What advice would you give them?
Well, I mean, I was not a refugee and I came here with my parents. So I would encourage folks to talk to others with experience with refugees, Syrian refugees and whatnot. But offhand, I will just say, I mean, first and foremost, some of these families handed their kids over to move here. So you have a lot of kids who don't even have their parents with them. And of course, we talk a lot about trauma in this country. But I think what they have gone through is probably the ultimate trauma you could possibly go through. But at the same time, they are excited to be in a free country and the opportunities here are nothing like what they had back home, even under the regime that was in place. So I would seize the excitement and interest they have in getting a good education and, you know, set aside the kind of, I don't know if you want to call them the self-bigotry of low expectations, but I think, you know, they're all here. And the fact that they are in a free country is something that I would imagine they all cherish immensely. And again, I think because of No Child Left Behind and everything else that's happened since then, there is a greater awareness around students who for whom English is not their first language and more resources available now than I would think was available before. So, you know, again, my advice would be to seize this opportunity to educate them, but also apply some of the trauma-informed techniques that that we are familiar with in making sure that we're making the environment in which they live a safe place for them to learn.
You've spent your career in much of your career in education policy and now in charter schools. How much has your experiences influenced the policy and the work that you're doing today in education?
You know, I love this question. And it's one of those things that I've thought about more in recent years. When I moved to Washington, D.C., I just wanted to get a job on Capitol Hill. And I somehow fell into the education field haphazardly. I was working at a public interest law firm in the mid-90s that litigated on behalf of low-income families who wanted access to better public schools. And I connected with these families simply because, you know, at the time, I just thought, gosh, if they could only have access to the local Catholic school down the street from which they live, their kids would just be better off. So the fact that they didn't have access and we had to fight so hard for them to access these private schools or to cross, you know, their district lines to go to a better public school didn't seem right to me. So I started writing about their stories, and the writings were published at the time by the Heritage Foundation, and ended up working at the Heritage Foundation right around when President Bush, Governor Bush at the time, was starting to explore running for president. So I fell into this role kind of haphazardly, but I think the reason, now that I reflect back, you know, why I sort of felt an affinity. I mean, it's easy to fall in love with the families who want their kids to access better schools. Any parent can identify with these families in a real way. And I encourage anyone who's skeptical about choice to meet some of these low-income families, because you very quickly, you know, will understand why they want their kids to go to better schools. And the kind of the math in their head and the reasoning that they give is no different than that of any other affluent family who has already made a choice to send their kid to a great public school or to a private school. So yeah, I mean, I think for me, because my family's left under the circumstances in which they left, the reason they moved to the US and the opportunities that I was given, because I was able to access, public education in this country, certainly made a huge difference for me personally. And I think if you are not attending a school that fits your unique needs, you are going to be at a disadvantage. So what I love about charter schools is the fact that they offer a great public education in the very communities where these families live. You don't have to go, you know, you don't have to move somewhere else. I live in DC, where nearly 50% of the students are now in charter schools. And I like to tell people that when you compare the variety and diversity of the charters in this city to the private school community, the charter sector is even more diverse. You have STEM schools, you have schools that have a more back to basics curriculum, you have schools that are focused on vocational education, you have schools that are focused on teaching kids multiple languages. So arguably, because of the regulatory system that's in place governing the DC charter sector, because of the choices available to families, these, you know, lower income families now have access to real options. They don't just have to pick from, you know, the public school that they're in, or conceivably a private school, since there's also a voucher program in DC. Now they have access to multiple options. And to me, that's what you want. You want to make sure people are not just stuck in one system, and that they have the opportunity to pick something that's uniquely suitable for their kids. The more we do that, and I think, you know, with COVID, we now have more evidence about the importance of options. The more we do that, the better off the students are in terms of identifying their path forward.
One of the things that I hear all the time, I'm sure you do too, even though they've been around for 30 years, people sometimes get confused about what charter schools are or aren't. And I'm wondering if you could just quickly define for our listeners, what is a charter school?
Yes, in the US? That's a great story. And unfortunately, a lot of the questions we get about charter schools are the same questions that people were getting, or I was getting back when charters were first being conceptualized. Charter schools are public schools. They are governed by an entity that is often not the school district, although school districts are also equipped to authorize charter schools in many states. So other than the school district, a state can authorize a charter school, a university, or a nonprofit. And so basically, again, depending on the state law, you're given a contract on average 5 years to do certain things differently in exchange for raising student achievement. And then upon the 5 year or whatever the term of the contract is, that authorizer renews your contract if you met the terms of the contract. These are also schools of choice. No one is forced to go to a charter school. So this combination of an outside entity holding you accountable as well as being a school of choice creates a dynamic that encourages and incentivizes the school leader to do whatever he or she needs to do in order to meet parent demand, but also make sure the school is, raising student achievement.
Thank you. That's great. I know I get that question a lot, and I will only, I don't work on charters full time. I can imagine you're answering that question a lot. And I think it's important for people to understand it's a public school. It's not a private option.
Let me also say, look, so it's public. It cannot teach religion. It is held from an accountability standpoint. All the civil rights laws apply to charter schools. The one area where, again, depending on the state law, charters have a lot of freedom and flexibility is in hiring teachers. So in most of the states or the states with the stronger laws, you have the freedom to hire teachers, give them differentiated pay, expand the school day, school year without having to negotiate with the teachers' unions. So that is one of the distinctive features of chartering. And again, state laws are very different from one another. So if you go to one charter school in one state, you've really just gone to that one school. So there, it's difficult to draw general conclusions about the rules and regulations that govern the law. But I would say the fact that they're authorized by an entity that's usually outside the political process that a traditional district is governed under is the distinctive feature. And also, if a charter is not performing well, it can and has been closed. So no school, no charter school, is open in perpetuity. And a lot of them have closed either for financial reasons, they weren't able to attract a lot of families, for accountability reasons, if they were not raising student achievement, and or other reasons.
I think that's a really important point where you just ended is that we're used to, and we hear a lot about neighborhood schools or more traditional district schools that have been failing according to accountability measures in one way or another for years, right? And you can imagine there's years of students who've gone through, but it's very unusual. It's for a school, a traditional district school to close. That's not a typical outcome that we see. But as you mentioned, I think in charters, that cycle happens a little more quickly, perhaps a little more market responsive. That's a strange term to use, but right, they have to recruit students in, their enrollment has to be at a certain level. There's perhaps a more immediate feedback loop, so the great ones can grow, the ones that are really serving kids and families well are growing and typically expanding, and the ones that don't quite hit it, you'll see fade away. I wonder if you could just talk about that, the impact of that, because that's a really different way of doing business, that how charter schools have that sort of more immediate accountability than you might see in a traditional district school.
No, absolutely. And since you're in Texas, Texas is a great example of a state that has also changed its law over time in order to give a leg up to the high-performing schools so that they can scale faster and also close the poor performers. The other thing that's an interesting and important feature of our sector is this constant need by a lot of our leaders and our organization in particular to make sure we're perfecting our craft and we're not kind of resting on our laurels and saying, okay, well, we've done enough, we can stop now. We're always trying to make it better. So not only our authorizers are held to account to make sure the schools are performing well, but in those instances where we've seen that model not working, there has been a lot of attempts in the state legislature by advocates to improve the quality of the law by giving authorizers greater tools. Ohio is another example of a state that made some huge improvements to its law recently in their case, they had a very large online school that was not performing well, and eventually that school was closed. But as a result, if you look back at this past year, they also leveraged some of the momentum around COVID to make other improvements to their law. But the central point is, if you are a high-performing charter school, federal law now and many state laws have put in place features to allow you to expand faster and ease the process through which you get reauthorized. But we also very much believe that you have to constantly keep the door open for newcomers to come in and challenge the status quo so that this this reform doesn't get too stale. And so that we noticed a few years ago that the growth of the sector had plateaued a little bit. And one of the reasons for that may have had to do with the fact that a lot of philanthropic support and public support may have shifted towards scaling high-performing charter schools and ignoring the newcomers. And I think we need to really do both of those at the same time and to constantly also expand into new communities so that more parents become familiar with what a charter school is. So to your question earlier about all the misconceptions, we're only 6% of the total public school market, about 7,500 charter schools serving 3.3 million students. In some communities, our presence is large, like New Orleans, where every school is a charter school, or in Washington, D.C., where I just mentioned nearly 50% of students are in charter schools. But in most communities, it is just a fraction of the student population. So the reason why a lot of people don't know what a charter is because they don't have access to them.
Yeah, they're not living in New Orleans or in D.C. or another city. I want to ask you about parents, but before I do that, I wanted you to talk a little bit about the kinds of principals and teachers and staff who tend to be attracted to charter schools. I think it's an interesting, what you mentioned earlier about how you have more flexibility in hiring, typically in a charter environment, I think is a really interesting element of how these schools develop. I think there's probably a little more entrepreneurial, creative spirit sometimes that comes to that. About a decade ago, I was part of a team that helped launch a charter network in Los Angeles. I was so blown away by the principals and the teachers and how they thought about their craft, how they engaged with students and parents. It was just a really different, it was just sort of a little bit different perspective. And I learned so much from being around them. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the kinds of educators you typically might find in the charter sector.
I would say that, so when you go back to the individuals who conceptualized this idea, Al Shanker, the former head of the American Federation of Teachers, was one of them. Ray Buddy is another individual. So a lot of them were interested in charter schools because they wanted to give teachers greater freedom and agency to run their classrooms as they wanted to run them and experiment with different pedagogies. And so quite a few of the new individuals who started charter schools back then and to this day are teachers. And the reason they were attracted to this model is because they wanted to try something different. And because they had the experience in the district system, they really understood the importance of the freedoms you get with chartering around simple things, even like being able to buy your paper when you want to buy it or from the vendor you want to purchase it from, rather than to wait, you know, and purchase it from a centralized bureaucracy. So that spirit has remained in place. But there are other individuals who've also been attracted to the space over time. And as you mentioned, the entrepreneurial spirit is very much alive and well in this sector. We've been very interested in, you know, really making sure that other individuals with some experience in the education space, whether it's before and after care and, you know, people who are part of the community are also taking a look at the chartering model, because ultimately you want to make sure that you have more individuals on the ground in these communities owning chartering rather than for outsiders to come in and open schools. You know, I think if you have a great program and you want to scale, it's great to expand them into other states. But those models that have thrived and succeeded are usually homegrown. Or if they are going from one state to another, they've really connected with the community in a real way. They're not just transporting teachers from one state to another. So I don't know if I'm answering your question properly, but So it's a wide variety of individuals, but I would say that a good portion of them are people from in the initial group of people who started charters certainly came from the district. What's interesting also is in states like California, when charters first passed in that state, the districts leveraged chartering to kind of reform or restructure their failing schools. So, you know, that's another way to leverage chartering to do things differently. And I've often wondered why districts are not leveraging their power as authorizers more to do different things in the chartering space. Some communities like Baltimore County has done so pretty well. But by and large, when districts are authorizers, not only do they not authorize a lot of charter schools, but from an accountability standpoint, interestingly enough, they're not paying as much attention as they should be in, you know, making sure the schools are doing well, or closing them if they're not doing well. So that's one of the areas that I think we need to also pay attention to going forward.
That's great. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about parents. I think everybody who's got a child in school over the last, you know, 20 months or how many since the pandemic started have a very different perspective on their school, for that their children may be attending there, or sort of seeing children that they know and love attend, reading about it in the news. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the impact of the pandemic on sort of chartering and education, and what you see parents may be asking about or doing differently, given their experience over the last almost 2 years now.
No, that's a great question. I think when you look at all the polls that have taken place, EdChoice, National Parents Union, one thing is clear in that parents were exposed to their kids' education greatly in the past 18 to 20 months. And in many instances, that exposure is a huge opportunity for us to leverage. In many instances, we're about to release a report in the next couple of weeks looking at enrollment in charter schools in the last school year, and those numbers across the board have increased regardless of the state that you're in. So again, greater awareness, because all of a sudden parents became their child's teacher at the same time, even if they were monitoring what the child was doing on a laptop, they were more engaged. But also, in many instances, if the district was not offering something, they started to look at other options. If they were affluent, had the means, they were hiring the local teacher to come and educate their kids in pods. And or if they had the option to go to a charter school that was fully virtual and whatnot, they were exercising those options. So it's a great moment in time for us to seize and leverage this interest and enthusiasm to better engage families in education. With that said, I also think there is a great sense of fatigue. This school year started, many of the classrooms are now, you know, fully open, doing in person. But I was in Cleveland a couple of weeks ago, and I was on a local NPR show, and the local reporter was talking about how this one local school district in Ohio had to close because of an uptick in COVID cases. So as we monitor what happens in the next few months, it will be interesting to see how much that will continue to fuel parents' engagement and interest, or whether that will, make them wish they want to go back to how schools used to be. I think as educators and as policymakers, we should seize this moment to do three things. First of all, continue to push choice and charters, and many states have already done that. Governors of states like Ohio and Tennessee and Florida have already kind of leveraged to this moment in time to talk more about options and giving parents access to greater opportunities. But at the same time, there are other very simple things that needs to continue to happen. One of them is making sure your teachers know how to teach virtually or in a hybrid setting. Because we don't know if there's going to be another pandemic or another moment where kids have to be home. So training teachers so that it doesn't take months to train them again in the future will be important. Access to technology, hardware, software, making sure children have Chromebooks at home and at school, that needs to become part of the DNA of the school. And then lastly, and this is going to be a little bit more challenging, I mean, one of the things we discovered all of a sudden is, you know, snow days used to be a day where kids would go back home and play around, but you don't have to do that anymore. Now that you have these things in place, you can really leverage technology to offer education anytime, anywhere, expand the day and the year more seamlessly. And I don't know, again, how many states are going to seize this moment to lean in and make some fundamental changes in how they educate their kids and move their kids, you know, because now you can basically monitor each child one at a time and offer opportunities for them depending on where they are in their coursework. So to the extent competency-based learning and those types of reforms are taking traction, I feel like those are the things we should be talking more about.
Despite the, you know, growing up in Minnesota, snow days were like so key when we got a snow day. But now, as you know, a grown-up, I understand I'd rather have them in school, right?
Be in school. I personally still love a good snow day from work. I still go out and play on a snow day and forget about virtual work.
But it is, I love that, like when you sort of were so used to operating in this sort of traditional calendar and the traditional time, and it's really interesting to think about the possibilities for kids and what learning can look like when you sort of take away what we assumed were permanent constructs or guardrails, right? I think there's lots of room for creativity and some of that entrepreneurial spirit about what's going to actually serve kids well, depending on their context, which is really exciting to think about what people will do.
I know, and I'm sure you've seen the polls by Frank Luntz that demonstrate parents don't want to go back to what they consider to be normal,
yeah.
But how much you can push them to, you know, move along the spectrum and push the envelope towards some of these things remains to be seen. So that's where I think choice and options matters a lot. So if you have more opportunities to pick and choose a setting that fits your child's needs, you don't have to come up with a one-size-fits-all model. You are giving parents the option to either stay in a program that is fully in person or one that's hybrid or virtual if they don't feel safe sending their kids back. So it'll be interesting to see what permanent changes are made after this is over, or if it ever is fully over.
And we see that not just in education, but across every industry. This is a time of great change, and with change comes opportunity. And it sounds like, you know, yourself and other educators are working to make the best of what is a challenging situation. And as a leader, of an organization, is that something that, how are you tackling that within your organization?
For us, we're a small organization, and we're fortunate enough that we have funders who have continued to support us during this difficult time. And I always see every challenge as an opportunity. And maybe that is I do think that's one of the hallmarks of immigrants. They see opportunities faster. And
absolutely.
But I mean, I think what's great about what I do every day is the fact that I'm in touch with these individuals who run our schools, who are also used to blocking and tackling and pivoting quickly. And when you look at when the pandemic first hit, we have example after example of charters that went above and beyond to make sure that they were offering remote learning very fast. So whether it was a single site that didn't have resources to go virtual or ever a program like Uncommon Schools in the Northeast part of the country that had the resources to fully pivot to virtual learning quickly. Every one of them did something to serve the needs of their communities through homework packets, going door to door, calling their families. But those that were better resourced also made everything that they were offering online for anyone who wanted to draw down their lesson plans and modules and whatnot. So to me, that is one of the greatest kind of success stories of our movement and something that we're extremely proud of. The other thing that I should also point now, with all the discussions around mask mandates and, you know, critical race theory and whatnot, what's great about charter schools, again, is that they are schools of choice and they're governed by, you know, a quasi-independent entity. And you know, if you really want parents to have options and choices in these types of discussions, a charter is seemingly one of the better things to put in place, because you are not forcing people to do one thing or the other. They can always move to another system if they're not happy with what they're getting in their traditional system or, you know, other school that they're attending. So that's why the governance model of chartering is something that I think we need to talk more about. And sometimes, because we're trying to come up with broad one-size-fits-all solutions that fixes the problem, we may forget some of the opportunities we have to really talk about the importance of options, you know, at the school level for families, and also to give traditional systems some of the tools that the charter sector has in order to do things a lot faster and at the same time serve the unique needs of the communities they serve.
Well, you know, this has been really enlightening. Really appreciate you taking time out of your morning to talk to us. I know I've learned a lot from this discussion, and always do when hanging out with Anne, and really appreciate you spending this time with us.
Sure. No, thank you so much for having me, and look forward to hopefully seeing you all in person.
Yes.
Please.
Yes. Yes, Nina, and thank you so much for your leadership in the sector. I always think how much I learn from people who are leading charter schools in so many ways. And I appreciate the work you all do and the children and families that your schools are serving all over the country. It's really exciting. And we'll look forward to the year ahead and what they're able to accomplish.
Thank you. And thank you, Anne, to you and the Bush Center for all the work that you guys are doing. President Bush, you know, was very much committed to education and still yearning to have someone like him, in office at the state level and other places, because leadership, public leadership in these areas certainly is needed now more than ever before.
Amen.
You can learn more about the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools at publiccharters.org. And Nina's Twitter feed also has a lot of great content. Follow her at Nina Charters on Twitter. Nina, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
You can learn more about the Bush Institute's education reform initiative at www.bushcenter.org/edreform. We hope you enjoyed this episode. We'd love to hear from you. Send us a note at the Bush Center on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for listening.